Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, we'll talk with Bruce Horovitz, author of Justice Pursued, a new book about two men wrongfully convicted of murder but exonerated after 43 years in prison.
Well, it was obviously a very joyful day for them, but it didn't come without, you know, some consequences and some effects of having been in prison.
We'll discuss William Panton of the Panton-Leslie Trading Company.
By the end of his life, Spanish government officials saw what others had claimed earlier, that no concession was enough for William Panton.
And we'll go to the UCF Veterans Legacy Program Institute. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. Nearly half a century ago, two Jacksonville men were wrongfully convicted of murder and spent nearly 43 years in prison. Bruce Horovitz, author of the new book Justice Pursued, The Exoneration of Nathan Myers and Clifford Williams, explains what life was like for the two men in 1976.
Clifford had a fairly extensive criminal history dating back to his teenage years. And the area in Jacksonville where they lived was an area that, unfortunately was a center of some gang activity, drug dealing, and Clifford found himself very much wrapped up in that lifestyle. He was involved with a gang at the time known as the Boomerang Gang, and by his own admission, he was involved in some drug trafficking and some gang activity. Nathan, on the other hand, was his young nephew. He was a high school student at Sandalwood High School here in Jacksonville and was really a football star with a promising future. He was very athletic, had contemplated and was thinking about some going to college to play football and actually was hoping to get some scholarship offers. But at the same time, he was very much influenced by his uncle, who was in the gang and drug activity business. And he got caught up in that lifestyle again by his own admission. He tells me he was living large at the time and people didn't think he'd graduate from high school. And his uncle made the lifestyle very attractive to Nathan. Clifford was operating out of a pool hall in downtown Jacksonville, and he let his young nephew manage the pool hall. And the drug dealing lifestyle, you know, came with some perks.
Nathan drove around town in a Cadillac Eldorado that police knew was owned by his uncle Clifford and had access to apartments and hotel rooms. He succumbed to the lifestyle that drug dealing provided. On May 2, 1976, Jeanette Williams was murdered and her partner Nina Marshall identified Myers and Williams as the shooters.
The neighborhood on Morgan Street, which is again in this area where there was drug activity and some gang activity, and there was a birthday party going on at an apartment in Morgan Street that was only, 50 yards or so away from an apartment where Nina Marshall and Jeanette Williams were living. Nathan Myers also spent time at that apartment and had a room there. But on the evening or the early morning of the murder, both Clifford Williams, Nathan Myers, and about 30 other people were attending a birthday party that was around 50 yards away from where Nina Marshall and Jeanette Williams were living. And sometime around 1 or 1:30 in the morning, the people at the party all said that they heard what sounded like gunshots. And so they went down from the party, several of them, including Clifford and Nathan, went down from the party to the nearby apartment complex. And it was there that Jeanette Williams' body was found in bed. She had been shot to death. And Nina Marshall had also been wounded in the shooting, and she was able to leave the apartment, get a ride to a nearby hospital. And it was at the hospital that she identified the shooters as being Clifford Williams and Nathan Myers. She wasn't really able to speak, but she scribbled it on a piece of paper. And there was a policeman on duty at the hospital who was familiar with Clifford Williams' name. Showed her a picture of him, and she identified them as the shooters. And so shortly after that, the two men were arrested for murder and attempted murder at the scene. And this is despite the fact that in interviews with those attending the party, that almost to a person, they all said that Nathan Myers and Clifford Williams were at the party when they all heard the shots heard, and that no one saw them leave the party either before or, you know, immediately after the shots being heard.
Unfortunately for Myers and Williams, none of those eyewitnesses would be called to testify during their murder trial. Bruce Horovitz.
There was a practice at the time in the 1970s that was allowed in the state of Florida. It's no longer allowed, but there was a practice where in a traditional trial as we know today, at the end of the trial, the prosecution gives the first closing argument, the defense then gives a closing argument, and then the prosecution is allowed to have the final word before the jury. But back in the 1970s, there was a practice where the defense could opt to have the last word before the jury, but there was a catch. And that catch was, if they opted for that, they were not allowed to call any witnesses other than the defendant themselves, or that was it. They weren't allowed to call any other witnesses or put on any evidence. And so the defense attorneys at this particular trial opted for this strategy of the last word before the jury, and therefore none of the witnesses who had heard the shots were called to testify. There was also some forensic evidence that was never introduced. For example, both men were tested for gunpowder residue at the end of the, or shortly after their arrest, and there was no gunpowder residue found. And there was also some conflicting evidence as to Nina Marshall's story, where she said the shooters had walked into the bedroom and fired from the foot of the bed, whereas some evidence seemed to indicate that the shots came from outside the apartment through the window. And none of that evidence was ever introduced. No witnesses were called. And the defense attorneys relied primarily on the evidence of the surviving victim, Anita Marshall, and they tried to impeach her credibility. She was involved in drug activity. Her story changed in terms of what happened the night of the shooting, although she never wavered from her contention that both Clifford Williams and Nathan Myers were the shooters.
Both men were given life sentences. The judge overruled the jury's recommendation and sentenced Clifford Williams to death. The Florida Supreme Court overturned that ruling and reinstated the life sentence. Both men were imprisoned for more than four decades. Melissa Nelson was elected state attorney in 2016.
Upon her election, one of the first things that she did was create something called the Conviction Integrity Review Unit. And this was a new thing that sort of popped up across the country, where prosecutors began re-looking at cases to correct wrongful convictions. And this was usually done in concert with the Innocence Project and other judicial advocacy groups. And this was the first one in Florida. She had met with some folks who had sort of said that this was something that would be a good service to have in Florida. And Melissa was someone who wanted to bring trust back to the state attorney's office. She was very, very popular in her election. She ran sort of on a campaign that said that she would be, you know, hard but fair. And this was one of the first things that she committed to, was creating one of these units in the state of Florida. And so the news broke that this conviction integrity unit was being formed. And one of Nathan Myers' cellmates saw that this was being started in Florida, and urged Nathan to petition the state to review his case. And so his case was one of about 80 that landed in the Conviction Integrity Unit's office when they first opened. And because of the nature of his petition, he had documented a lot of the facts of the case. It seemed to be worth investigating. And so that's how it all sort of got started.
The Conviction Integrity Unit thoroughly reviewed the evidence and determined that if the jury had heard all of the facts in the case, that Myers and Williams would not have been convicted. New tests were done that indicated that several elements of Nita Marshall's testimony were untrue. In 2019, Nathan Myers and Clifford Williams were released from prison after almost 43 years when it was determined that they were not only not guilty of Jeanette Williams' murder, but were most likely factually innocent.
Well, it was obviously a very joyful day for them, but it didn't come without, you know, some consequences and some effects of having been in prison. Clifford Williams was very frail and ill when he was released. And shortly after his release, he was diagnosed with an aggressive form of prostate cancer, which resulted in his being treated almost immediately with proton beam therapy to treat his prostate cancer. And so he was not well when he got out of prison. Had he not been released, you could most likely conclude that he would have died in prison. As it turns out, Clifford Williams just recently passed away. For Nathan Myers, Nathan, you know, remained in very good physical condition. His memory is very good, but it was a big adjustment for him. He was constantly looking over his shoulder. There was a degree of paranoia with the police coming back for him. He never really felt totally free until he, you know, sort of got himself back into society, and it was a difficult adjustment. He actually met his wife while he was serving time. And they've been married, and he's living a very nice lifestyle now. He spends his time with church and doing advocacy work, and he has adjusted, but it hasn't all been an easy adjustment. Each man did receive compensation for their time in prison, which was also a little bit of a battle, but each man received a little more than $2 million for their time in prison based on the Florida's wrongful conviction compensation law.
Bruce Horovitz will be discussing his new book, Justice Pursued, The Exoneration of Nathan Myers and Clifford Williams, Saturday, February 24th at 2 p.m. at the Library of Florida History in Cocoa. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to watch our public television series Florida Frontiers and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, two of the central figures in late 18th and early 19th century Florida history are William Panton and John Leslie, Scottish merchants who operated the Panton-Leslie Trading Company. Arriving in Florida during the British control, they survived the transition back to Spanish control and thrived at a time when loyalty to the ruling monarch was a prerequisite to doing business.
In his fall 2017 article in the Florida Historical Quarterly, David Narrett, a professor of history at the University of Texas Arlington, argues that Panton and Leslie were the, quote, the most politically adept merchants of the Florida shores from the height of the American Revolution until the close of the 18th century, end quote. Arriving in Georgia in the 1770s, the two men remained loyal to George III when the American Revolution broke out. To escape harassment, they fled to East Florida and the safety of that loyalist colony. However, when the 1783 Treaty of Paris returned Florida to Spain as a reward for supporting the revolutionaries, the future of the Panton-Leslie Company seemed bleak. The two men had built a substantial business in the deerskin trade, quote, supplying southern Indians with arms and goods in the fight against the Americans and Spaniards, end quote. As Narrett explains, however, quote, Panton and Leslie remained by persuading Spanish authorities that their commercial experience was indispensable for Madrid to gain southern Indian loyalty and to stave off United States expansion, end quote. With trading posts on the St. Johns River, at St. Mark's on the Gulf, The addition of a post in Pensacola in 1785 placed Panton Leslie in a position of near monopoly of the deerskin trade, with opportunities to use indigenous debt to the company to gain large land cessions from the Lower Creeks and Seminoles. By the mid-1790s, Narrett claims, Panton Leslie, quote, acted more like a transnational corporation than a simple business partnership, with a political and commercial impact felt within all major Southern Indian societies and across territories disputed between Spain and the United States, end quote. To accomplish this, Panton Leslie formed, quote, a hybrid political loyalty. The partners pledged fealty to the Spanish king, even while reserving their national allegiance to Great Britain, end quote. Allegiance to England was more than national pride, as the nation was, quote, the source of credit, supply of goods, and the outlet for deerskins, end quote. Arranging such an unusual and complex loyalty depended on the acquiescence of British and Spanish officials, and the outgoing British governor lobbied the incoming Spanish governor on behalf of Panton and Leslie, claims. In 1786, Panton swore his oath of loyalty to the Spanish monarch before Colonel Arturo O'Neill, an Irish Catholic in Spanish service at Pensacola.
Connie, despite Panton's remarkable diplomatic skills and negotiating an oath favorable to his business, it wasn't all smooth sailing for the trading company.
Narrett explains that, quote, Spanish self-interest trumped narrow nationalistic or religious considerations, end quote, in the decision to accept Panton's changes to the oath of loyalty. The company had extensive contacts with all indigenous tribes from the Mississippi River east and from the Gulf to Kentucky. Panton also had an important ally, Alexander McGilvary, described as, quote, the dynamic Creek leader of Scots Indian ancestry, whose literacy, intelligence, and influence greatly appealed to Spanish authorities, end quote. McGilvary deeply resented the British land cessions that placed his people within the boundaries of the United States. The House of Panton also had a number of enemies within the Spanish government and among business competitors, some of whom were well known in history. Among his enemies was Colonel O'Neill, who administered his oath. O'Neill initially supported Panton, but changed his mind over the merchant's continuing efforts to obtain additional advantages. He was also skeptical of Panton's ally, McGilvary. He came to believe that Panton would, quote, never feel emotionally attached to the Spanish government, end quote, a lack of loyalty that would prove harmful if Spain and Britain warred against one another. In 1789, however, the Spanish Supreme Council of State ruled against O'Neill's arguments that the merchant had an English heart. Panton's anti-American feelings and his ability to influence indigenous people toward support for Spain seemed too valuable to the council to reject his privileges. In other words, Spain assessed the situation in the most realistic terms. Panton's other enemies came from within the community of merchants, men who resented the many trading advantages and the continued quest for additional advantages that the House of Panton enjoyed. Two of his business enemies were well known in Florida and American history. James Wilkinson, a Kentucky entrepreneur who was representative of those merchants whose primary trading partners were Spain and white settlers, and William Augustus Bowles, who challenged Panton's right to sell to indigenous tribes by roiling Indians against their increasing indebtedness to the House of Panton for manufactured goods. Wilkinson signed an oath of loyalty to the Spanish king, just as Andrew Jackson later did, in order to move his agricultural commodities down the Mississippi through the port of New Orleans. He, like other merchants, could sell to white settlers, while Panton's lucrative business was limited to the Indian trade. Although he did not allow the limitation to stand in his way, he was not able to control the settler trade. Wilkinson, of course, gained his place in American history as part of an unsuccessful plot to remove Kentucky from the Union and add it to the Spanish territory. Perhaps the person who most threatened Panton's economic hold was William Augustus Bowles, who attacked the merchant for increasing debt incurred by indigenous people who traded with the House of Panton. The merchant even hatched an assassination scheme against Bowles, claiming to be acting to protect Spanish interests. Fortunately, the Spanish governor acted quicker and captured the self-appointed director and general of the Creeks. By the end of his life, Spanish government officials saw what others had claimed earlier, that no concession was enough for William Patton. In 1799 and 1800, Spain denied his petition for trading rights west of the Mississippi River and for a monopoly on the Louisiana slave trade. Patton died in 1801, still grasping for additional concessions from Spain. For its part, no matter what the Spanish government conceded, they never received, quote, the love and affection, end quote, from indigenous people that Patton had promised in return for the concessions he did receive.
A fascinating story, and we have the Patton-Leslie papers right here at the Library of Florida History. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. Sebastian Garcia takes us to the UCF Veterans Legacy Project Institute in St. Augustine.
In last week's segment, I highlighted a conversation I had with K-12 educator Alexis Wood, who participated in the UCF VOP Institute, a 10-day educational program hosted by the UCF Department of History's Veterans Legacy Program to teach veterans history to K-12 educators across Florida to honor and memorialize veterans buried in Florida's national cemeteries. The conversation occurred during the climax of the Institute, in which teachers were rubbing the headstones of their veterans' graves to preserve their inscriptions. Whereas the previous segment captured a pivotal and emotional moment of the Institute, this segment, which features Florida K-12 educators Nicole Bennett and Judy Lindquist, reflects the teachers' larger experiences at the Institute, from their initial interest to tremendous takeaways. Let's begin with interest. There were several personal and professional reasons why the 2023 UCF VOP Institute attracted several K-12 educators, including Nicole and Judy.
I have veterans in every aspect of my life. My husband, my brother, my dad, both of my grandfathers, uncles. So to see this kind of program out there and to actually be able to become a part of it was a no-brainer for me.
In addition to learning so much, I always love being around other educators who are as committed to learning and growing themselves. And so even though we come in, you know, not knowing this content or, you know, how to approach this subject area, we all have that passion and that commitment. And I always leave so inspired by my fellow educators. And to me, in addition to learning about the Veterans Legacy Program and the National Cemetery System and all of that, I just love being surrounded by other passionate educators because it just always ups my game.
Once Judy and Nicole engage with the contents of the Institute, learning veterans history and how to conduct veteran history research, they began to understand with great clarity its significance for the study of the past.
It made me realize that teaching veteran stories is a great way to kind of get into the bigger picture of what's happening in the country or what's happening in the community and kind of teaching those bigger history issues through the very specific veteran.
Just the history of the records that we've looked at, the military records, the census, the internment cards, marriage certificates, any of that paper, that documentation that they had back then, because our kids are so used to the technology aspect of it, being able to show them this is how we kept how our history was kept for hundreds of thousands of years, and being able to show that to them and let them be able to look at it and learn from it.
Judy shared with me the veterans she had researched for over a week. Her meticulous attention to detail is a remarkable snapshot of the broader progression that most K-12 educators made with their deliverables during the 10-day Institute.
My veteran is Frank L. Spencer, and he was born in Key West, and he was one of 12 children. He was the sixth of 12. And when he was 8 years old, his mother died, and he was fostered to another family. And then before he was 15, he was fostered to a different family. But again, using those technology tools this afternoon, using those map tools, I was able to find out the families that he was fostered to, they all lived, like the streets were all adjacent to each other. So it was all within the same community. And historically, when we're studying these people, at least I initially was looking at everything through the lens of today. And when I saw, you know, he was fostered to someone, and then I'm thinking of the foster system we have today, which clearly is entirely different from the foster system of the 1920s. It was probably not formal. It was probably, you know, I can't take care of my children. You know, we know you, you're a close family, a friend, can you? That kind of thing. But back to Frank. Frank did die when he was 23. But again, the looking at kind of the legacy and the positive things, he had a younger brother, Eugene, who in the 1950s census, you know, 8 years after his brother had died, had a baby and named his brother after his dead brother. So, you know, there are those little nuggets of sunshine in some of these sadder stories as well.
For Nicole and Judy, the UCF VOP Institute shattered their expectations. Ultimately, they candidly revealed how the Institute was a tremendously transformative educational experience.
I didn't come into it expecting to get as much information and knowledge and experience that I did. And every night I'm walking away having to really go into my office and kind of tell my kiddos, hey, give me a few minutes. I need to decompress. I need to process everything that I've taken away from this experience. And when we're listening to them give their presentations, they're sitting there and have said, you know, did you take all the notes? Because I'm sitting here and I'm taking notes and I'm taking pictures so I can get the notes. And because I just want to get as much as I can. I want to be able to walk away and say, okay, I got everything that I needed to get, and I'm not going to forget it.
Well, and I have to also say, I've just been blown away by the knowledge and the skill of not just, you know, Dr. Gannon and not just, you know, Dr. Lyons, but all of the UCF students that they have brought along who have been mentoring. I don't know about you, but they have been mentoring and coaching and keeping propping me up when I just am not sure what to do next and how to use these tools. They have been phenomenal.
There hasn't been one aspect of this that I've walked away from and said, you know, I wish I got a little bit more. I everything, every speaker that they've brought in, every presentation that they've made has been just top notch and
I agree.
Given me more than I could have asked for in doing what they've asked of us.
I agree.
If you are interested in participating in the 2024 UCF VOP Institute or to learn more about UCF VOP, please contact Amelia Lyons at amelia.lyons@ucf.edu. To listen to my entire conversation with Nicole and Judy, please subscribe to the UCF Department of History's podcast, Knight's History Cast. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS Media Production Assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week and find us anytime at myfloridahistory.org and on Facebook. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.